It's funny. Usually when we talk about a team sport, there's this underlying assumption of visible conscious strategy.
Right, yeah. Like you can actually see the plan unfolding.
Exactly. Take American football, for example. I mean, the play stops completely. The quarterback calls out, a literal sequence of numbers and letters. Everyone lines up in the static formation. The coach points, the player goes, and you can practically see the X's and O's drawn directly on the turf. It's totally orchestrated.
It's deliberate, yeah. It's visible planning with these absolute pauses in between all the chaos just to reset the schematic.
Right. But then you step into the world of ice hockey, and suddenly that whiteboard is just thrown into a blender.
Yeah, it really is.
We are looking at a tactical landscape that is essentially invisible to the untrained eye. I mean, to most people, it looks like random chaos, but it's actually this incredibly rigid high-speed ecosystem. And it's governed by a matrix of rules that most people watching don't even know exist.
Which is exactly why this is just a perfect topic for our discussion today. The invisible ecosystem of hockey really is a masterclass in human psychology and, well, mechanical structure.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we're taking you, the listener, into the hidden machinery of the sport.
And our mission here isn't to just rattle off the basic rules, right?
No, not at all. We're operating under the assumption that you know what a puck is, you know what a net is, you know what the crease is.
Wait, you've seen a game before?
Exactly. Our goal is for you to master the invisible culture, the mechanical rulebook, and the unwritten conventions that actually govern how players interact.
Because by the end of our time together, the goal is that you should be able to step onto any ice rink or just watch any game on TV and instantly read the underlying logic of what's actually happening out there.
Because what's happening on the ice is, well, it's rarely what it looks like on the surface.
Definitely not.
We've curated an incredible stack of source material today, focusing entirely on team play, locker room culture, and the massive, sometimes honestly dangerous divergences in the four major rule books that dictate how this game is played globally.
And to kick this off, there's a concept from our sources that completely rewired how I understand team sports.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let's unpack this because this blew my mind
Well,
too.
wait. So if you are stepping into a hockey dressing room for the very first time, the fastest way to be accepted by that team has absolutely nothing to do with your individual skill.
Zero.
None. It's not about how fast you skate. It's not the velocity of your slap shot or, your ability to dangle through three defenders. It is entirely 100% about reliability.
Reliability. Just being someone they can count on.
Exactly. That concept of reliability is basically the foundational pillar of our entire discussion today. Because trust on a hockey team, it's not a feeling.
Right.
It's not this warm emotional bond. Trust is a prediction
A
problem.
prediction problem. I love that phrasing so much.
Yeah, and we're going to build this masterclass up from that one simple concept, escalating all the way up to, advanced tactical behaviors, the extreme nuances of different rule books, and basically how a team manages conflict at 20 miles an hour.
And because we want this to operate as a true masterclass for you, the listener, we really want this knowledge to stick.
We aren't just going to lecture at you for an
Yeah,
hour.
no. Periodically, we're going to pause and challenge you to synthesize what we've just discussed. Think of it as like a mental checkpoint to ensure you're building out this mental model alongside us.
So to build that model, we really have to start with the sheer physical reality of the sport, the physics of trust, if you will.
Right. To understand why trust is a prediction problem, we have to look at the actual mechanics of a shift.
Right.
So you have a 20-person roster in the NHL,
Yeah.
and usually, what, 12 to 20 players in a recreational league?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But only five skaters are on the ice at any one time. And they're only out there for roughly 30 to 80 seconds at a time. I mean, if a team is managing the game well, a shift is closer to like 45 seconds.
And crucially, substitutions happen during live play.
That's the crazy part.
Right. The game does not stop for you to change lines. The clock is running, the puck is moving, and players are just leaping over the boards.
So every single shift is this continuous act of delegation. When you leave the ice, five different people inherit your exact scenario.
Yes.
You are constantly playing with people you cannot see. So the way I was thinking about it, making a breakout pass out of your own defensive zone is less like passing a basketball to an open teammate who's just standing statically at the three-point line.
Right.
And it's more like merging onto a highway blindfolded. You're just trusting that the other cars are following the speed limit and will be exactly where they're supposed to be.
That is the perfect analogy. You are literally driving into a space under the assumption that the space will be managed according to the shared rules of your team. Because of the speed and all the blind spots, a defenseman starting a breakout, they cannot wait to see the winger arrive at the half wall before passing.
Because if you wait.
If you wait to see them, the passing lane closes, the window is gone. You have to release the puck to a spot on the ice before the winger actually arrives.
That's wild.
So that pass is not a reaction to visual stimuli. It's literally a prediction of future behavior.
Which means it's only a good prediction if you know what that particular winger does.
Exactly.
And this reframes the whole idea of team chemistry for me. Distrust on a hockey team isn't a personal issue. It isn't about whether you grab beers together after the game. Distrust is simply a breakdown in prediction accuracy.
And when that prediction accuracy breaks down, I mean, the structural collapse on the ice is immediate.
It just falls apart.
Totally. When players stop trusting that their teammates will be in the correct position, they stop leaving their own assignments to cover for them.
I want to visualize this for the listener. Can you walk us through exactly what that structural collapse looks like mechanically during a shift?
Yeah, absolutely. So imagine a team defending in their own zone. The puck goes deep into the corner. Your center skates down into that corner to battle for the puck.
Okay, pretty standard.
Right. Now, by leaving the middle of the ice, the center has vacated the most dangerous scoring area on the rink, the high slot.
Right, in front of the net.
Exactly. Under normal functional team dynamics, the weak side winger, that's the forward farthest from the puck, recognizes this. They immediately drop down from the point to cover that high slot. They rotate to protect the house.
So they're covering the space the center just abandoned.
Yes, perfectly seamless. But suppose over the last three shifts, that same center lost the puck in the corner and never rotated back up to cover the winger's original assignment at the point.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, the opposing defenseman got the puck, walked in, and scored. And then the winger got yelled at by the coach for leaving the point open.
Naturally.
So what is that winger going to do on the next shift?
The winger is staying glued to the opposing defenseman. I mean, they are not dropping down to cover the high slot because they can't predict that the center will actually have their back.
Exactly. The rotation dies. And without that rotation, the team concedes wide open shots from the slot. The structure vanishes because the trust vanished.
That is fascinating.
And you see the exact same thing offensively. Defensemen stop pinching down the boards to keep the puck in the offensive zone because they no longer believe the third forward will rotate back to cover the blue line for them.
So everyone just starts playing defensively.
Right. And a team that never pinches, never sustains offensive pressure, the entire system falls apart over a failed prediction.
That makes the concept of forechecking roles so much more interesting. Our sources dive really deep into this idea of F1, F2, and F3.
Oh, yeah, the F roles.
See, I always assumed these were static positions, like the center is F1, the right wing is F2, the left wing is F3. But that's a complete misunderstanding of the mechanics, isn't it?
It is a fundamental misunderstanding. F1 simply means forward one. It's a designation of time and space.
Okay.
It is whichever forward arrives at the puck or the zone first. That's it. F2 is the second to arrive, F3 is the third. They are highly dynamic roles based purely on the physics of the play in that exact moment.
I really want to break this down over like a 15-second sequence so we can really see the machinery at work here. Let's say our defenseman dumps the puck hard around the glass into the offensive zone.
Okay, so as the puck rings around the boards, the right winger happens to be closest. At that exact millisecond, they become F1.
Regardless of their actual position on the roster.
Right. And their job is singularly focused. Skate at maximum speed, take the body of the opposing defenseman retrieving the puck, and pin them to the wall. They are the disruptor.
Meanwhile, the center is trailing maybe a second behind them.
Right. The center reads the right winger's commitment. The center silently accepts the role of F2. Their job is not to hit the defenseman. Their job is to dive into the physical space the right winger just created and extract the loose puck from the pile.
And the left winger, who is furthest away on the dump in.
The left winger recognizes they are the last to arrive. They become F3.
And what do they do?
Well, their job requires immense discipline. They must stay high in the zone, near the blue line. They do not dive into the corner.
Because if they do, they're trapped deep.
Exactly. If the center and right winger lose the puck battle in the corner, F3 is the only forward position to stop the other team's counterattack.
That entire sequence requires instantaneous, completely silent agreement. Nobody is out there yelling, "I'm F1." They just read the physics of the play and fill the required structural void.
And this really brings us to the actual definition of chemistry. People always talk about chemistry as this mystical, intangible magic.
Like a mind meld.
Right. It isn't. Chemistry is constructed from two highly practical elements: complementary tendencies and shared assumptions.
So just the pieces of the puzzle fitting together mechanically.
Yes. A center who naturally loves to hold on to the puck and carry it through the neutral zone pairs perfectly with a winger who naturally loves to skate away from the puck to find open ice.
Right. That makes sense.
That is a complementary tendency. If you put three players on the same line who all want to carry the puck through the neutral zone, the line fails. They will constantly skate into each other's space.
And what about the shared assumptions part?
That's the F1, F2, F3 scenario we just mapped out. Shared assumptions mean that when the puck goes into the far corner, all three players already know the unwritten algorithm of how they will behave.
They don't have to think about it.
Exactly. And the sources are incredibly blunt about this.
Yeah.
Chemistry is almost entirely divorced from friendship.
Which feels so counterintuitive to anyone who hasn't played at a high level. I mean, you assume the guys who are best friends off the ice have this psychic connection on it.
Friendship certainly helps with off-ice communication, sure, but on the ice, repetition builds shared assumptions, not affection. I mean, there are legendary NHL lines composed of players who literally do not speak to each other outside the rink.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And conversely, there are best friends who are completely incompatible tactically.
So if I'm a player and the coach puts me on a line with someone whose tendencies completely clash with mine, what's the protocol? Do I pull them aside in the locker room and explain how they need to adjust their game to fit my style?
You never do that.
Never.
The adaptation runs from you to your line mate, never the other way around. Every hockey player has a small set of actions they reliably perform. Do they want the puck passed to their forehand or backhand in transition?
Right.
Do they tend to hold the puck an extra second, or do they chip it away instantly under pressure? How fast do they actually skate compared to how fast they think they skate?
So you have to map their actual reality, not what they say they do.
Your job as a teammate is to learn their specific set of tendencies and pass the puck to the player who actually exists, not the idealized player you wish you were playing with. Consistency is everything here. A predictably average teammate is infinitely more valuable than a brilliant, unpredictable one.
Because if you're predictable, I don't have to look at you. If I'm a defenseman retrieving a puck under heavy physical pressure, and I know my winger always supports the breakout on the wall, I can throw a blind pass to the wall and take the hit.
Yes.
But if my winger is unpredictable, I have to look up to find them. And looking up takes, what, half a second?
And that half second is how you get hit hard, how you turn the puck over, and ultimately how the puck ends up in your net. This is why the ultimate symptom of a team losing its prediction accuracy is so fascinating.
Okay, let's test our listener on this concept because it perfectly encapsulates this entire first pillar of trust.
Good idea.
Listener, if you've been tracking the mechanical logic of how players predict each other's movements, you might realize what happens when the fear of being wrong creeps in. When communication stops being helpful and starts being a liability, what is the single most expensive communication failure you can have on the ice? What does a team sound like when trust completely collapses?
Take a mental note of your answer here. If you said yelling or arguing, you missed the mark. The true answer is silence.
Silence?
Yeah.
Nobody calling out, "man," to warn a teammate about pressure. Nobody yelling "reverse" to signal an open passing lane behind the net.
Because communicating on the ice requires a tiny act of vulnerability. You might read the play incorrectly. On a dysfunctional bench where being wrong gets you mocked, players just choose self-preservation.
They shut down.
They go quiet, and silence takes over the ice, which physically destroys the ability to move the puck.
That is such a profound insight. Mm. The physical environment where that silence breathes or where that communication is fostered is the bench. Which brings us to section two. The geography of the game. If you're changing lines every 45 seconds, you're spending more than half the game not playing. So the bench isn't a spectator area, is it?
Not at all. The bench is a high-stress working position. And there is a near universal convention for how it operates mechanically, starting with the simple act of just sitting down.
You don't just sit anywhere.
No, you sit grouped by your line. The forwards sit in their units of three, your center, and two wingers are physically touching shoulders with you. The defensemen sit together, usually at the end of the bench closest to the defensive zone door.
Now, I know there is no official rule in any book that mandates a seating chart, but the mechanical reasons for this convention are vital, right?
They are absolutely critical. First, you change lines as a unit. If your three forwards are sitting in adjacent seats, they can go over the board simultaneously and arrive at the play as a cohesive structure.
And if they're scattered?
If they're scattered, they trickle onto the ice one by one, creating a massive territorial disadvantage. And second, NHL benches are 24 feet long. A coach cannot shout tactical adjustments down 24 feet of screaming players and arena noise. You need your line mates within whispering distance.
And as you wait for your shift, perched on the edge, the one thing you absolutely do not do is sit on top of the boards with your skates dangling over.
Oh, that transitions from a convention to a strict rule. NHL Rule 75.2, Section 4, makes it a minor penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct for any player sitting on the boards with their skates exposed during play after receiving one warning.
Which makes sense. Tactically, it's foolish, but safety-wise, it is just paramount. I mean, having exposed razor-sharp steel blades hovering at face level while players are checking each other into the boards at 20 miles an hour is catastrophic.
It's incredibly dangerous.
Let's dig into the actual mechanics of a line change on the fly, because here is where the different rule books globally completely diverge.
Yes, this gets really interesting.
You're standing at the bench door, you're visually tracking the play. Before you even move, you need to know exactly who you are replacing. You can't just jump out for a forward. You have to lock on to a specific human being.
You must verbally announce it to the player next to you. I've got the center, or I've got Smith. If two players on the bench both think they are replacing the same tired player, they both jump over the boards, and suddenly you have six skaters on the ice.
And that is an automatic too many men penalty.
Every time.
Okay, assuming you know who you were replacing, let's talk about the physical distance allowed for the exchange. How close does the tired player have to be to the bench before you can legally step onto the ice?
This is where the governance of the sport really splinters. Under NHL Rule 74.1, a retiring player must be within 5 feet of the player's bench and D out of the play before the substitute can step on.
5 feet.
5 feet. If the new player's skate touches the ice while the retiring player is 6 feet away, it is a 2-minute bench minor penalty. The IIHF, which governs international hockey and leagues across Europe and the UK, uses the exact metric equivalent, 1.50 meters.
5 feet is virtually nothing. I mean, if a player is gliding to the bench at 15 miles an hour, 5 feet takes a fraction of a second to cover. It's an incredibly tight margin of error.
It demands supreme discipline. However, if you cross the border into Canada, Hockey Canada Rules 6.1A actually doubles that margin. They allow a 10-foot window for the change.
Okay, 10 feet gives you some breathing room. But what about the American rulebook, USA Hockey?
USA Hockey Rule 204B writes no measurable distance into the rulebook whatsoever.
Wait, what? No distance? So a player could be 20 feet away, like at the blue line, and you can just jump on?
The rule simply states the retiring player shall always be at the player's bench and out of the play. There's literally no tape measure involved.
I'm trying to decipher the logic here. If USA Hockey essentially traded a measurable, strict distance for this vague concept of being at the bench, doesn't that open the door for massive exploitation?
You would think so.
Right, like can't a coach just have players jump on early to gain a positional advantage?
Well, USA Hockey anticipated exactly that loophole. While they removed the rigid tape measure distance, they added a devastating third trigger to their penalty criteria that the NHL doesn't have.
Okay, what is it?
In the NHL, a premature change is penalized if the players are too far apart, or if either the retiring or substituting player touches the puck. USA Hockey penalizes you for touching the puck, plus if the premature change causes their team to gain a competitive advantage.
Walk me through a scenario where that applies, because competitive advantage sounds incredibly subjective for a referee to call at high speed.
It does, but the USA Hockey casebook outlines a very specific nightmare scenario for a coach.
Let's hear it.
Imagine your team is defending a 2-on-1 rush coming toward your defensive zone. One of your forwards is exhausted, skating back to the bench. They're close to the bench, maybe 6 feet away. The substitute forward sees the 2-on-1 rush, panics, and jumps over the boards early.
Okay.
Neither player touches the puck, but the substitute forwards sprints back and turns the 2-on-1 against your team into a 2-on-2.
So they saved a potential goal.
Right. Under NHL rules, if that player was within 5 feet and out of the play, that change might be deemed perfectly legal. But under USA Hockey, the referee blows the whistle. Penalty.
Because they gained an advantage.
Exactly. Team A gained a positional and territorial advantage specifically as a result of the early substitution. You cannot use a line change as a tactical defensive deployment.
Let's push that to the extreme then. Third period. 30 seconds left on the clock. My team is winning by one goal. The other team gets a clean breakaway. A player is skating alone toward my goalie. What stops me as a coach from just pointing at a player on the bench and screaming, "Go!" Sending a literal sixth man onto the ice to tackle the breakaway player, I will happily take a 2-minute minor penalty to prevent a game-tying breakaway.
You might be willing to take a 2-minute minor, but you will not take the penalty shot that the referee is about to award the other team.
A penalty shot? For a line change violation?
Yes. 2 minutes in the penalty box is the price of an honest, accidental miscommunication. A deliberate, tactical extra body sent over the boards at the end of a game is priced much higher. NHL and IIHF Rule 74.4 mandate that if a bench minor for deliberate illegal substitution is imposed and the penalty time cannot be served in its entirety within regular playing time, a penalty shot is awarded.
Because there isn't enough time left on the clock for a 2-minute penalty to actually punish the team.
Exactly. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada are even more draconian on this. They fix a precise window. Any deliberate illegal substitution in the final 2 minutes of regulation or at any point in overtime results in an automatic penalty shot.
Wow.
Sending a hit squad over the boards to stop a breakaway does not save a goal. It simply guarantees the opponent a free, uncontested shot at your goalie.
So the geography of the bench is just a complete minefield, and we haven't even touched on the most suffocating rule in the game regarding line changes, the icing trap.
Ah, yes. The icing trap. When your team is trapped in your defensive zone, exhausted, and a player blindly clears the puck from your side of the red line all the way past the opponent's goal line without it being touched, that is an icing. The play stops. The ensuing faceoff comes all the way back deep into your defensive zone.
And crucially, under NHL Rule 82.1 and IIHF Rule 81.4, the offending team is strictly forbidden from making any substitutions. The five exhausted players whose lungs are just burning must stay on the ice for the defensive zone draw.
Right. The opposing coach, meanwhile, gets to deploy a completely fresh line of their best offensive players. It is a terrifying physical disadvantage.
Are there any escape valves for this? Any exceptions to this rule?
The NHL allows three highly specific exceptions where you can legally change after your own icing. First, to replace a goaltender who had previously been pulled for an extra attacker. Second, to replace a player who is visibly injured. Third, when a penalty has been assessed on the play that alters the on-ice numerical strength of either team.
Goalie injury or penalty. That seems logically sound. But I understand the international rulebook, the IIHF, has a massive contradiction regarding these exceptions.
It does, and it centers around equipment failure. The IIHF rulebook writes a highly controversial fourth exception into Rule 81.4, a player with a broken skate. If a player snaps a steel blade during the icing, they are allowed to change.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I mean, you physically cannot stand on the ice without a blade.
It makes sense until you read three paragraphs further down. Rule 82.1 restates the icing substitution prohibition and explicitly lists the exceptions. It lists the goalie, the injury, and the penalty. It completely omits the broken skate.
So the rule book grants you an exception on one page and revokes it on the very next page.
Yes. And the IIHF Situation Handbook, which referees use to interpret ambiguous rules, cites both contradictory rules together, but never once mentions a broken skate in any of its practical scenarios. It is a glaring editorial failure in the rulebook.
That's crazy. So if I'm a player in a British league playing under IIHS rules, and I blow out a skate blade on an icing, what is the mechanical procedure? Do I just crawl to the bench?
You show the official your broken blade, but you prepare yourself to stay on the ice. Do not, under any circumstances, have a teammate jump over the boards to replace you.
Because they'll penalize you.
Well, if you attempt an illegal change under IIHF rules, the referee will send the replacement player back and issue a formal warning to your coach. Any subsequent violation results in a bench minor for delay of game. In the NHL, there isn't even a warning. An attempt to change illegally after an icing is an immediate, automatic penalty.
Brutal. But once again, USA Hockey takes a completely different philosophical approach to this entire concept, don't they?
They do. USA Hockey imposes absolutely no substitution bar after an icing. Under American amateur rules, your exhausted five players can casually skate to the bench and change lines after an icing.
That completely alters the late game strategy of preserving leads. If you can ice the puck with impunity and change lines, the pressure is entirely different.
Completely different game.
Okay, let's pause. We just covered a dense geographical web of line change rules. Listener, if you are synthesizing this, think about that USA Hockey distinction. If you are playing in an adult league in Chicago, governed by USA Hockey rules, and you're deeply exhausted, defensive pairing ices the puck. Can they skate to the bench for a change?
If you've been following the divergence in the rule books, the answer is yes. They can change lines. The icing trap just does not exist in USA Hockey.
All right. We've established the physical positioning on the bench. Let's transition to section three, the psychological positioning on the ice. Because the physics of hockey guarantee one thing. Mistakes will happen.
Inevitably.
Predictions will fail. Pucks will bounce over sticks. Your defense partner will pass the puck directly to the opposing center. How a player manages that moment of failure is a massive tactical consideration.
It really is the ultimate test of emotional discipline. When a teammate commits a glaring error, your physical reaction to that error can instantly compound a minor mistake into a structural catastrophe, specifically visible frustration.
We all know the guy who slams his stick on the ice when a pass misses him or throws his head back dramatically to look at the feeling. It feels like a natural emotional release, but our sources categorize this as a massive tactical error.
It is destructive on four distinct levels. Let's walk through the mechanics of a player slapping their stick on the ice in frustration after a teammate turns the puck over.
Okay.
First, you have just broadcasted actionable intelligence to the enemy. You have told the opposing bench exactly where the emotional fracture in your structure is.
Right.
If an opposing coach sees a defense pairing expressing frustration with each other, they will deploy their most aggressive forecheckers against that specific pairing on the very next shift. You literally gave them a target.
You're playing poker, but you've turned your cards around for the whole table to see.
Precisely. Second, it poisons your own bench. Every player on your team sees you shame your partner. Now, every player on your bench understands that if they try a creative pass and fail, they will be publicly humiliated by their own teammate. The entire team's creativity plummets.
And the third consequence is purely physical.
Right.
Time.
Yes. The 2 seconds you spend dramatically throwing your hands in the air are 2 seconds the air. You are not transitioning into a defensive posture. You are not back-checking. In the NHL, a scoring chance develops from nothing in less than 2 seconds. You are taking yourself completely out of the play to perform a pantomime of frustration.
Wow. And the fourth consequence.
You make the teammate who made the mistake actively worse. A player who is terrified of your emotional reaction will begin playing with hesitation. They will pass the puck away a second too early just to avoid the responsibility of holding it. You degrade your own team's skill level.
So the rule of thumb is, you can show visible frustration at your own mistakes, maybe,
yeah,
and never at a teammate's.
Right.
But let's apply this. How do you practically help a teammate who is imploding? Let's take the most visible, high-stakes position on the ice. The goaltender.
Oh, man. Yeah.
The puck is shot from the red line. It's a weak bouncing shot. It somehow trickles right through your goalie's legs. A horrifyingly soft goal. The arena goes dead quiet. What is the tactical protocol for the skaters on the ice?
The protocol requires extreme minimalism. You skate by, you tap them on the shin pads, you say two words like next one, and you skate away.
Wait, really? You don't try to pump them up like, hey man, you're the best, shake it off, you gotta close that gap faster.
Never analyze a soft goal with a goalie. They know exactly the mechanical failure that led to the puck going through their legs. They are painfully aware of it. Attempting to comfort them by discussing it forces them to mentally dwell on the error.
That makes total sense.
The absolute best support you can provide is not verbal. It is structural. You go to center ice, you win the ensuing faceoff, you clear the puck deep, and you execute a perfectly boring, structurally sound shift where the opposing team gets zero shots from the middle of the ice.
But there is a human instinct to overcompensate when you feel bad for someone. The sources highlight this as a major tactical trap teams fall into after a bad goal.
It is the instinct of a sympathetic but undisciplined team. The team feels terrible for their goalie, so on the next defensive shift, all 5 skaters collapse tightly around the crease. They try to block every single shot physically to protect the goalie.
Why is that a bad thing, though? It sounds like great teamwork.
It is disastrous for 2 reasons. Psychologically, it tells the goalie, we do not trust you to make a save right now, so we have to do your job. It reinforces their lack of confidence.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
And mechanically, crowding the crease creates a wall of human bodies that screens the goalie's vision and creates unpredictable deflections.
Oh.
That is exactly the environment where another soft goal occurs. You must play your normal, assigned structure.
Let's pivot to a skater then. A forward who is having a genuinely catastrophic night. They're fumbling the puck, they're falling over, they've caused two turnovers that led to goals. The human instinct is to stop passing to them, to freeze them out of the play so they stop hurting the team.
Freezing them out is the most damaging reaction possible. It confirms their internal monologue that they are a liability, and it virtually guarantees they will not recover in that game. You have essentially reduced your own team to a four-man unit on the ice.
So what is the alternative? Keep giving them the puck while they are turning it over.
You keep giving them the puck, but you change the geometry of the pass. You give them a pass they cannot possibly fail to execute.
Like what?
A gentle, flat, 5-foot pass when they are under absolutely zero pressure. Confidence in a high-speed sport is rebuilt through successful, simple motor functions. You do not try to, you know, redeem them by firing a 60-foot stretch pass to them for a highly contested breakaway. You let them feel the puck on their tape, make a simple 5-foot pass back, and reset their nervous system.
And when they come back to the bench, how do you handle the verbal feedback?
You praise effort, not outcome. If they had a terrible shift but skated hard on the back check to catch an opponent, you say, great back check. If you try to give them outcome-based praise when everyone knows the outcome was terrible, it sounds deeply patronizing.
And if you're playing in a local adult league, you can deploy the ultimate perspective reset. You tap them on the shoulder and say, mate, it's a Tuesday night. You instantly lower the stakes.
Exactly.
Okay, listener, let's lock in the psychological pillar. If you understand the tactical mechanics of confidence, you'll know exactly what not to do. If a teammate is having a nightmare of a game and turning the puck over constantly, why must you never freeze them out and stop passing to them?
Because isolating them guarantees their core performance continues, it validates their lack of confidence, and it physically removes a functional asset from your team's on-ice ecosystem. You must rebuild them with simple, guaranteed touches of the puck.
Brilliant. We have spent a lot of time on how a team manages its own internal dynamics. Now we have to look outward. Section 4. How does a team interact with the opposition? This introduces the fascinating sociology of the sport. The massive gray territory between what the literal rulebook dictates and what the unwritten cultural code demands.
The unwritten code exists to fill the gaps where the written rulebook either fails to provide protection or where the rules are too slow to adjudicate human behavior. Let's examine the most sacred geography on the ice, the goaltender's crease.
That painted blue semicircle right in front of the net. The unwritten cultural convention is absolute. During a stoppage in play, after the referee blows the whistle, an opposing player does not skate through the crease, they do not stand in the crease, and they certainly do not shoot a puck into the crease.
Goaltenders literally scrape the snow out of that blue paint. It is their sovereign territory. Standing in an opponent's crease after the whistle is the universally recognized provocation to start a physical altercation with all five opposing players. It is an intentional act of disrespect. But here is the sociological twist. There is not a single word in the rulebook that prohibits it.
Wait. There is no rule saying I can't just stand in the blue paint while the referee is getting the puck ready for a face-off.
None. The rulebooks only govern the crease during live active play.
Yes.
And even during live play, the rules are shockingly lenient depending on which continent you were playing on.
Break that down for us. How does the NHL handle the crease during live play compared to, say, USA Hockey?
Under NHL and IIHF Rule 69.1, an attacking player's physical presence inside or outside the crease does not automatically disallow a goal. A goal is only disallowed if the attacking player physically impairs the goaltender's ability to move freely or initiates deliberate physical contact. Establishing a physical screen to block the goalie's eyes from outside the blue paint is completely 100% legal.
But USA Hockey treats the blue paint differently.
Drastically differently. USA Hockey Rule 625B enforces a flat, uncompromising positional bar. No goal may be scored if an attacking player is physically standing in the goal crease, unless the puck entered the crease before the player did, or the goaltender was already out of the crease. It is a rigid geographical boundary. Hockey Canada takes a middle ground, allowing a goal to stand if an attacking player is in the crease, provided they remain totally passive, do not interfere, and do not obstruct the goalie's line of sight.
But regardless of the rulebook, protecting that space after the whistle relies entirely on the culture of the players enforcing it themselves.
Entirely.
Let's talk about another cultural convention that frankly blew my mind. Warm-ups. The source material emphasizes that it is a cardinal sin to shoot a puck at your own goalie's head during pregame warmups, which, yes, common sense dictates you don't concuss your own teammate, but surely there is a rule against shooting at someone's head.
This is where the gap between the rulebook and reality is actually terrifying. There is no rule in any of the major rulebooks that penalizes a player for shooting at their own goalie's head in warmups. It is purely an unwritten convention. And the reason this convention is enforced so brutally by teammates is because the rulebooks provide shocking little mandatory protection for a goalie who takes a puck to the head during the actual game.
Unpack the mechanics of that. If we are in the middle of a game and a goalie takes a 90-mile-an-hour slap shot square to the fiberglass mask, the referee blows the whistle and stops play immediately, right?
Not necessarily. In the context of a stand-up goalie style or situations where the mask remains fastened, only 2 of the 4 major rule books even write a specific stoppage for a puck hitting the mask, and they are highly conditional.
Let's look at the IIHF, which governs the UK and Europe. What is their protocol?
IIHF rules state the referee may stop play for safety reasons if they believe the goalie is dazed by a hard shot to the mask. But there's a massive caveat. They can only stop it if there is no immediate scoring chance for the attacking team. It is an entirely discretionary call by the official.
If I'm reading the underlying logic here, if the opposing team grabs the rebound off the goalie's face and is about to shoot it into an empty net, the referee is instructed to let the play continue while the goalie is potentially concussed on the ice.
Yes. The scoring opportunity supersedes the immediate medical stoppage if the helmet is still on. Hockey Canada is slightly more protective, stating the referee shall stop play, but only in minor hockey categories of U13 and below. The NHL and USA hockey rulebooks write absolutely no mask-specific stoppage requirement for a mask that remains on the head. They only guarantee an automatic whistle if the helmet physically flies off the goalie's head.
But the NHL has a general injury rule. Doesn't that cover a concussed goalie?
NHL Rule 8.1 states play is stopped for an obvious serious injury. But consider the physical reality of a goaltender. They were wearing bulky chest protectors, massive leg pads, and a full cage fiberglass mask that obscures their eyes and facial expressions. If a goalie takes a puck to the dome and drops to their knees, they are the hardest player in the entire arena for a referee to visually diagnose with a serious injury. The referee cannot see if their eyes are rolled back.
So the unwritten code teammates actively choosing not to shoot high in practice and players not taking full wind-up slap shots from 3 feet away is the only real safety net the goalie has. The culture is carrying the weight that the rulebook refuses to hold.
Exactly. And the unwritten code extends to the opponent's side of the ice during warm-ups, too.
Right. Do not cross the center red line and absolutely do not shoot a puck into the opposing team's net during warm-ups.
Though in this specific instance, the cultural convention is actually backed up by the written text. NHL and IIHF Rule 86.6, USA Hockey 636C, and Hockey Canada 2.2 all explicitly confine teams to their own half of the rink during pregame warm-ups.
But the enforcement mechanisms are completely different. If a player in a Canadian or American amateur league skates over the red line and shoots at the other goalie, what happens?
The referees on the ice can assess a penalty right then and there.
And in the NHL?
The NHL and the IIHF explicitly forbid the on-ice officials from penalizing warm-up violations. The rule states the violation must be formally reported to the commissioner or the proper authorities. It bypasses the referee entirely and goes straight to the league's disciplinary committee.
So crossing the red line in an NHL warm-up isn't just an etiquette breach that gets you 2 minutes in the box. It's a fast track to a league-mandated suspension and a massive fine.
Correct. The league treats it as premeditated escalation, not a spontaneous on-ice infraction.
I want to address a missing piece here regarding culture versus rules.
Yeah.
The concept of running up the score. Let's say a clearly superior team is winning 8-0 in the second period. Is there an actual mercy rule in professional hockey?
In professional rulebooks like the NHL, there is absolutely no mercy rule. The game demands 60 full minutes regardless of the score.
So how does a team handle that culturally?
Through immense self-restraint. The unwritten code dictates that the winning team stops deploying their top power play unit if they get a penalty. They stop executing high-risk, flashy offensive plays, they dump the puck deep, and focus on running the clock down. If a team continues to aggressively try to score on a beaten opponent, the losing team will eventually abandon playing hockey and resort to physical violence to protect their pride. The unwritten code prevents the game from devolving into a bloodbath.
This raises a fascinating philosophical question. Are we saying the actual literal rule book matters less than the cultural conventions of the players?
We are saying the rule book is merely the skeletal framework of the sport. The cultural conventions are the muscle and tissue that allow the sport to actually function at high speeds without players constantly injuring each other. The rulebook cannot mandate respect. The culture has to.
Let's stick with injuries for a second to see how this plays out. The unwritten code demands that if a player goes down awkwardly and isn't getting up, you stop playing. You yield the puck so the whistle blows. But what does the literal NHL Rule 8.1 dictate?
The rule book is coldly pragmatic. Play is not stopped for an injured player until their own team has secured possession of the puck, unless the injury is obviously catastrophic. But there is a crucial, fascinating second clause to this rule. If the injured player's team already has control of the puck at the exact moment the injury occurs, play is stopped immediately, unless that team is in a scoring position.
So the context of the geography overrides the injury.
Yes. If your teammate gets blown up by a massive body check at center ice, but you have the puck and are crossing the opposing blue line on a two-on-one odd man rush, the whistle will not blow.
I get to finish the rush.
You get to finish the rush. The rules prioritize the manifestation of a scoring chance over an immediate stoppage, provided the injury isn't life-threatening. But if you were just cycling the puck harmlessly in the corner of your defensive zone when your teammate went down, the whistle blows instantly.
Now, if it is a life-threatening scenario, a head or neck injury, the unwritten code and the rule book completely align. The protocol is absolute.
Yes. This supersedes all tactical considerations. If a player suffers a suspected head, neck, or spinal injury, you do not move them. You do not attempt to roll them over. You absolutely do not unbuckle or remove their helmet, as that manipulates the cervical spine. You assume the worst.
The rink convention is usually to rapidly tap your stick on the ice or wave frantically at your bench to signal an injury. But the sources are very clear that this is insufficient.
Waving at your bench is a hockey convention to tell your coach you need a substitute. It does not summon an ambulance. In an adult recreational game at midnight, there is likely nobody in the building with advanced medical training. Waving at your buddies on the bench achieves nothing. The protocol is explicit. One person physically stays with the injured player to keep them totally immobilized, and a specific designated person must physically leave the ice to dial emergency services.
Let's lock in this section on culture versus rules with a review. Listener, put yourself in the skates of an attacking player. You are carrying the puck over the blue line on a clear two-on-one rush. Behind you, at center ice, your teammate takes a heavy legal body check and falls to the ice, clutching his knee. Does the referee blow the whistle immediately to stop the play?
If you internalize the pragmatic nature of the NHL rulebook, the answer is no. Unless the injury is obviously life-threatening, the rules grant you the right to complete your scoring opportunity before the play is halted.
Which brings us to a critical juncture. Section 5. Authority, escalation, and conflict. When the unwritten code fails, when tempers flare, and when a team vehemently disagrees with the ultimate authority on the ice, the officials, how is that conflict managed?
It is managed by understanding that the rulebook is incredibly brutal and unforgiving toward anyone who challenges the authority of an official. The hierarchy is rigid. Let's start with who is actually permitted to speak to a referee.
The captain, the player with the C's stitched onto their jersey.
Yes, but the parameters of that communication are highly restricted. Under NHL Rule 6.1, only the captain has the privilege of discussing rule interpretations with the referee, and only when invited to do so.
Wait, the captain cannot just skate up to the referee and ask a question. They must wait for an explicit invitation.
That specific invitation clause is unique to the NHL rulebook. It ensures the referee dictates the pace of the game, not the players. The IIHF rulebook restricts the speaking privilege to the captain, but removes the strict requirement for an invitation. USA Hockey takes a more egalitarian approach. The privilege belongs to one designated player, which could be the captain or an alternate captain.
And what happens if the captain is currently serving a penalty or is sitting on the bench?
Under the NHL framework, an alternate captain with an A on their jersey can speak to the official, but only if the actual captain is not physically on the ice. Interestingly, across both the NHL and IIHF rulebooks, goaltenders are universally barred from serving as captains.
Right. The famous Bill Dernan rule. The story goes that the Montreal Canadiens goaltender was named captain, and he kept leaving his crease to argue with the referees, slowing the game down so much that the league officially banned goalies from wearing the casey.
It is a fantastic piece of hockey folklore, but historically, it is mostly a myth. Bill Dernan was indeed a captain who frustrated opponents by taking his time discussing calls, but there is no definitive historical documentation proving the rule was written explicitly to stop him. The rule book simply groups goaltenders with playing coaches and managers as individuals ineligible for the captaincy, likely for logistical tidiness. You don't want your goalie skating 100 feet to center ice to discuss a hooking penalty.
And once again, USA Hockey does things differently.
USA Hockey actually allows a goaltender to be named the captain of the team. They can wear the C, however, they cannot exercise the privilege of leaving the crease to speak to the referee. A designated skater must handle the actual communication.
So let's say the captain is invited to speak. Can they complain about a terrible penalty call that just went against their team?
Absolutely not. Rule 6.1 is incredibly blunt on this matter. It explicitly states, a complaint about a penalty is not a matter relating to the interpretation of the rules. The moment a captain shifts from asking for clarification to complaining about the judgment, they are subject to an automatic minor penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct.
So arguing with an official literally never works.
Arguing has essentially never reversed a subjective call in the history of the sport. NHL officials do not have the mechanistic authority to rescind a called penalty based on a player's verbal protest. The only mechanism for reversal is video review for highly specific infractions. Arguing simply guarantees you a minor penalty under Rule 39.2i.
And if a player sitting on the bench decides to yell at the referee,
the penalty ladder escalates rapidly. If a player comes off the bench to physically protest a call, it is an automatic minor. If you think the rulebook offers a gentle warning system, you are deeply mistaken. Deliberately applying physical force to an official in any manner is an immediate game misconduct and routes directly to the league for an automatic suspension of up to 20 games. Leaving the penalty box to challenge a ruling is a game misconduct plus an automatic 3-game suspension in the NHL. The rulebook does not negotiate with emotional outbursts.
Which perfectly sets up the ultimate scenario of emotional escalation.
Yeah.
The absolute pinnacle of hockey disaster.
Yeah.
The bench emptying. A massive fight breaks out on the ice. Your teammate is getting double-teamed by two opponents. The primal instinct is to jump over the boards, join the fray, and protect your teammate.
That is the loyalty instinct, and it is the worst mathematical, tactical, and cultural mistake you can make in the entire sport.
Break down the mechanics of why that instinct is so wrong. Because to a player, it feels like the honorable thing to do. It feels like you are protecting your team's integrity.
Let's analyze it from a purely logical standpoint. From the bench, the only useful, constructive thing you can contribute to that scenario is not being on the ice. The teammate you are rushing out to protect is already being separated by the linesman. The fight is ending. That teammate is already going to the penalty box, or they are getting ejected from the game. All you have achieved by jumping over the boards is getting yourself ejected as well and leaving your team completely shorthanded for the remainder of the period.
Walk me through the exact literal penalties for leaving the bench. Because there is a massive misconception among casual players that it just results in a 2-minute minor.
It is drastically more severe than a minor. All 4 major rule books mandate at least an immediate game misconduct to any player leaving the player's bench during an altercation. And there is a persistent myth in amateur hockey that only the first guy off the bench gets penalized. That is totally false. USA Hockey Rule 629 assesses a 5-minute major penalty plus a game misconduct to every single player who leaves the bench.
Wait, a major penalty means the team has to play shorthanded for 5 full minutes. So if 3 guys jump over the boards to help, the team has to kill off multiple major penalties.
Yes.
It is a mathematical catastrophe, and the NHL takes it even further to ensure it never happens. NHL Rule 70.9 dictates that the first player to illegally leave the bench during an altercation is automatically suspended for 10 games without pay. The second player off the bench is suspended for 5 games. If you leave the penalty box to join an altercation, that is an automatic 5-game suspension.
The league uses extreme financial and career penalties to override human emotion.
Exactly. Teams that successfully avoid the bench-clearing disaster don't make the decision in the heat of the moment. They have a predefined cultural agreement established in training camp. Nobody leaves the bench, period. The math dictates it. Okay, time for a critical retrieval review for our listener. Imagine you are on the ice. The referee makes a truly horrific, objectively incorrect call against your team that costs you a goal. What is the most effective, tactically sound phrase you can yell at the official during live play to get the call reversed?
The answer is absolutely nothing. You say nothing. You channel your frustration into the physical execution of your next shift, and you allow your designated captain to ask a polite, clarifying question at the next whistle.
Let's bring this massive, high-stakes NHL framework down to earth for Section 6, because the vast majority of our listeners who play this sport aren't playing for millions of dollars. They're playing in an adult recreational league, commonly known as a beer league, at 11:00 p.m. on a Tuesday night.
And the culture in recreational hockey requires an entirely different matrix of predictions. The environment is entirely different. You have a massive disparity of skill on a single roster. You might have a former Division I college player sitting on the same bench as someone who learned to ice skate 3 years ago.
So how does the concept of predictability and trust adapt to that massive skill gap?
It requires extreme empathy and adjustment from the highly skilled players. If you are the former college star, you do not fire a 60-mile-an-hour saucer pass to the beginner's backhand. That is not a great pass that they missed. That is a turnover you caused because you failed to accurately read your line mate's physical capabilities. You must adapt your output to their processing speed. And crucially, you do not coach your teammates from the bench.
Don't coach from the bench. Why is that such a hard rule in rec hockey?
Because nobody pays thousands of dollars in league registration fees to be lectured by an amateur teammate who works in accounting. It destroys locker room chemistry instantly.
Let's clarify the physical rules in these adult leagues. Almost all recreational leagues are categorized globally as non-check leagues. A lot of players, especially those transitioning from other sports, hear non-check and assume it means no contact. They assume it's like basketball. If you touch me, it's a foul.
That is a massive and sometimes physically dangerous misconception. Under USA Hockey Rules 604, non-check absolutely does not mean no contact. Ice hockey is inherently a collision sport based on confined geography. Angling an opponent into the boards to deny them space, engaging physically shoulder to shoulder while both players are actively skating toward a loose puck, and holding your legally established physical space on the ice are all entirely legal in a non-check league.
So what mechanics actually constitute a checking penalty in a non-check league? Where is the line drawn?
The penalty is defined by intent and separation, using overt hip, shoulder, or torso action to deliberately step into an opponent with the sole purpose of separating them from the puck, making no physical effort to play the puck yourself with your stick. You cannot line someone up. You cannot finish your check after they have released the puck.
Does this definition hold true globally? What about listeners in the UK or Europe?
It is a vital distinction for our international listeners. Women's hockey, under the IIHF rulebook, which governs all levels of the women's game in Britain, operates under a framework called restricted contact, not a blanket non-check prohibition. IIHF Rule 101.1 explicitly allows body checking when there is a clear, overt intention to play the puck. It penalizes stepping into an opponent purely to hit them or using the boards to pin them forcefully. It is a completely different conceptual framing than USA Hockey's rigid non-check rule.
But the golden rule of recreational hockey overrides all rule books, all skill levels, and all competitive instincts.
The golden rule is absolute. Everyone has work in the morning. Nobody on that ice is earning an NHL contract. Winning an 11:00 p.m. recreational game is never worth a broken collarbone, a torn ligament, or a concussion. You keep your stick on the ice, you do not retaliate to cheap shots, and you allow the teenage referee to manage the game without screaming at them.
If I'm a listener and I've just moved to a new city and I'm joining a new adult league team, how do I actually become that reliable, trusted player we discussed at the very beginning of this deep dive?
The checklist for immediate locker room acceptance is shockingly simple, yet profound. Turn up to the rink 45 minutes early to dress and socialize. Pay your league fees to the captain before they have to chase you for them. Reply to the team organizer's scheduling text messages immediately. Ask the captain what the team's defensive zone system is and then strictly adhere to it on the ice, even if you personally believe a different system is vastly superior. And keep your shifts strictly under 60 seconds. Reliability keeps your name on the roster permanently. Your specific skill level simply dictates which forward line you are assigned to.
Let's do our final periodic retrieval before we synthesize this entire masterclass. Listener, imagine you are playing a late-night rec league game. The opposing team is vastly superior to yours. They are younger, much faster, and much stronger. Should you instruct your team to trade rushes with them, pushing the pace to play a high-speed, run-and-gun offensive game to try and keep up?
If you internalize the mechanics of predictability and structure, the answer is a definitive no. You simplify. You retreat. You get pucks deep into their zone. You keep your shifts incredibly short to maintain physical energy. And you absolutely clog the middle of the ice defensively. Trying to trade fast break rushes with a physically superior team is exactly how a respectable 4-1 loss violently spirals into a 9-1 humiliation.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with the blindfolded highway merge of a breakout pass. We dissected the mechanical differences between a 5-foot and 10-foot line change. We mapped the psychological danger of slapping a stick on the ice and the brutal mathematics of jumping over the boards during a fight.
And all of these highly disparate elements synthesize into one overarching coherent mental framework. The entire sport of ice hockey is an ecosystem built entirely on the concept of predictability. The rules, both the written literal text and the unwritten cultural code, exist for one singular purpose: to remove unpredictable variables so that five independent human beings can act as a single cohesive unit at blinding speeds.
It is all an elaborate mechanism for reducing uncertainty.
Exactly. The line change distances dictate exactly how you substitute so you don't end up with six players. The unwritten warm-up conventions dictate that you don't shoot at your goalie's head so you don't injure your most critical asset. The strict emotional control ensures you don't broadcast your structural weaknesses to the enemy. Every rule, every custom is a stabilizer in a fundamentally chaotic environment.
To wrap up this masterclass, we want to leave you with the three fundamental philosophical pillars of the sport. If you only remember three concepts from this entire deep dive, these are the mental models you need to carry with you to the rink. Number one, the math of trust.
Trust is a prediction problem. It is not an emotional bond. It is the silent mechanical agreement of F1, F2, and F3. You must adapt to your line mate's actual tendencies, and you rebuild a struggling teammate, not by freezing them out, but with guaranteed simple interactions. Silence is the sound of trust failing.
Pillar number two, the geography of the rules. The physical space on the ice dictates your legality.
Knowing the specific rulebook you are operating under is non-negotiable. Whether you have 5 feet, 10 feet, or a subjective competitive advantage window to change lines alters your entire tactical deployment. Whether you can change lines on an icing or whether you can stand in the blue crease is dictated by the specific book governing your league. The geography is rigid.
And pillar number three, emotional discipline as a tactic.
Visible frustration is a tactical error that actively feeds the enemy. Arguing with officials is a mathematical guarantee of failure, and the loyalty instinct of jumping over the boards to join an altercation is the single most destructive action a player can take. The unwritten code relies on players enforcing respect, but the rulebook brutally punishes any player who loses emotional control.
We began this discussion by comparing the sport of hockey to American football. How football is a visible, engineered schematic, while hockey appears to be a murky, invisible blur of random chaos. But hopefully, after systematically unpacking the mechanics, that blur has come into sharp focus for you. You can now see the underlying matrix.
You can see the predictions being made in real time, the shared assumptions executing silently, and the hidden structures holding the chaos together.
So we want to leave you with one final provocative thought. The next time you are watching a hockey game, whether it's the NHL playoffs or a local Tuesday night rec league, don't watch the puck. Watch what happens in the exact moment a player decides to break the unwritten code. Watch the player who selfishly stays out for a 2-minute shift. Watch the player who screams at the teenage referee. Watch the player who aggressively slaps their stick on the ice when a pass misses them. Look closely at the ecosystem around them. Does the play break down because of a sudden lack of athletic skill? Or does it break down because the invisible math of trust just collapsed?
The physical execution of the game relies entirely on the structural integrity of the team. When that predictability shatters, the entire system falls apart.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. You have mastered the material. Now go watch the ice.